This podcast is for general information only. It is not intended as a substitute for general healthcare services. If you have medical conditions, you need to see your doctor. Use of this information is at the user's own risk. Welcome to FitRx with Dr. Greg Dennis. Join me as we challenge the standard sick model of healthcare. This is your source for everything health, wellness, prevention, fitness, biohacking, and more. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of FitRx. I'm your host, Dr. Greg Dennis. Today, we are going to talk all about the thyroid, which is, as I'm sure you know, a very commonly diagnosed problem in this country. And we're going to talk about how kind of the standard of care has viewed it all wrong. And if you listen to this podcast, I'm sure it's no surprise to you that I question a lot of things in the quote standard of care. And I realized a while back that thyroid was one of those that we just that gets mismanaged a lot. And I definitely, you know, look at the thyroid differently than what I used to. But then I came across this book called The Thyroid Debacle. That really sheds a lot of light and even, made me think differently than I already was about the thyroid. And so I have one of the authors of this book, Dr. Eric Balcovich. Did I say that right?
Close enough. Okay. You got it.
And so he is a doctor of chiropractic medicine who transitioned over into now he's pretty much just doing functional medicine. And he co-authored this book with Dr. Kelly Halderman, who is a medical doctor. I believe she also practices some functional medicine. And so anyways, Eric, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, all right. Well, first, I guess just take us through how in the world a practicing chiropractor got involved in a thyroid and then going on to write a book about thyroid.
Yeah, so I really didn't have any intention on getting into thyroid physiology, but my background originally when I graduated was a medical technology major. And so I was working in the hospital setting. I was the guy who was doing all the blood and urine and poop and all those tests. When you got those samples done, they would come to the lab and I was the guy that was running all those tests. But I knew, I thought I was going to go off to med school, but wound up my chiropractor who helped me in college get back on the field convinced me to go to chiropractic school instead. So I was just going to be, I was doing chiropractic and loving life and just having a good old time. And I got a call from my brother and he mentioned some of the struggles his wife was having. She was diagnosed with hypothyroidism, iron deficiency and fibroids. And he's like, hey, you need to do something about this. I'm like, this is not what I do. And he's your big brother. So he says, you're going to figure it out. So, you do what you got to do. So I went back to my roots in blood chemistry and started digging in a little bit. And that led me into looking into functional medicine. And there was the time when I got involved, Apex Energetics was doing a lot of education. Tatis Garazian was like kind of the guru in functional medicine at the time. So I took all those courses and in the process of digging into those courses, realized what was going on with my sister-in-law. And then I realized that what she had going on wasn't really three separate conditions, but all really part of a bigger issue. And so we were able to help her improve. But as I was learning all this stuff, I started talking to my client base in my chiropractic practice. And I guess I never really paid attention to it that much of how many people were on thyroid medication. And when you ask the vast majority of them, how did they feel? They felt a little bit better, but they still felt unhealthy. They felt unwell. They still struggled with weight issues and chronic symptomatology. And so that led me into kind of digging in deeper and then starting to work with some of those people. And then that slowly and steadily became the most the biggest part of my practice. Somewhere along the way, I was lecturing and kind of on the circuit of doing lecturing. And a friend of mine, Dr. Ben Lynch, sat down with me one day and he's like, "You need to write a book." And I was like, "I don't even know how to write a book. You know, I don't know what to do." And he's like, "Yep, but that's what you need to do." And so I started writing the book, and I wasn't getting very far. Because I wasn't really committed to getting the project done. And then my friend Kelly Halderman asked me to help her put together and organize a 3-day bio presentation and seminar. And I was like, "Man, I don't have time for that. I'm working on this book." But then I thought, you know what, if I can get her, I'll help her, and then I'll get her on the team, and then I'll be more committed to getting the process done. And so that's kind of how the whole thing came about. And it was kind of a bit of an odyssey to get the book done, but you know, now I'm happy to have it out, and I'm getting good reviews and good comments. And like we were talking right before we got on, you know, I'm surprised where the book's gone and what people from all over the world picking that book up and buying it. And hopefully it's helping a lot of people understand their physiology a little bit better.
Okay. Well, very cool. Well, let's get into the book a little bit. So the first part is titled Confessions of an Allopathic Doctor, and that's written, I guess, by Dr. Halderman. And I don't know if you want to speak for her, but kind of summarize that section, if you will, on kind of her take on all this and her involvement in this.
Yeah. So Kelly, Kelly's a brilliant woman and a physician, and, you know, she did, you know, the medical training and kind of went through all the kind of the similar training you went through. And at some point she started having her own health issues and health crisis and realized, I think it really hit home what was going on in allopathic medicine. And she wasn't able to kind of get the type of treatment she was hoping for. Essentially, as she talks about in the book, she was essentially said, "Hey, you've got this condition, you got MS, you're going to just go home and kind of get your stuff in order. And this is going to be a long, slow decline." And she wasn't accepting in that and found functional medicine and wound up getting her naturopathic degree and really helping herself get well by changing her paradigm from what she learned in allopathic medicine, and incorporating the things that we talk about so often in functional medicine.
So the next part is titled Hypothyroid Seen Through a New Lens. And that's probably where we'll spend most of our time here. So for those listening that aren't on thyroid medication or don't know much about that, kind of historically, what doctors do when they screen for thyroid is they check something called a TSH, or a thyroid stimulating hormone. And if your TSH is normal, then they'll say, "Well, your thyroid is fine." And then if it's not, they may put you on thyroid medicine, and then they monitor your dose of thyroid primarily just with the TSH. So I practiced that way for many, many years, unfortunately. But I guess first, if you will, talk to us about what's wrong with that model.
Well, the model is focused on determining when somebody has a thyroid gland that no longer can produce thyroid hormone, and then simply replacing the thyroid hormone that the gland's not making. And so it's a very gland-centric, and it essentially ignores the fact that thyroid hormone production by the gland is just a part of thyroid physiology. There's a whole rest of the story that doesn't get told, which is thyroid hormone needs to be made primarily, most of it's T4 that's made by the gland, and then it needs to enter the bloodstream. It needs to be transported around the body. There's things that can interfere with that process. Then it needs to get into the cell, and there's things that can interfere with that process. And then the cells get to regulate what happens to that thyroid hormone, whether it's the primary hormone made by the gland, T4, or the primary active hormone, T3, that's primarily made in the peripheral cells. And the cell, if it's in a homeostatic state, it may maybe a higher metabolism and want to convert that T4 to T3 and stimulate more metabolism, or it might be a cell that doesn't need an increased metabolism, or it's sensing what we call danger physiology and wants to downregulate its metabolism. In that situation, that T4 can be deactivated to an inactive form called reverse T3, and the T3 can be deactivated to a form of something, another form of thyroid hormone called T2. And essentially all of that stuff isn't ever looked at or talked about, or and nothing's done about it. And as soon as you're, if you don't have an elevated TSH and a low free T4, you're considered normal. Even if you're sitting in front of your physician and your hair's falling out, and you're constipated and you're overweight and you have all the signs and symptoms of hypothyroidism, you're probably going to be told there's nothing that can be done for you at this point. We'll manage the other symptoms, but you don't have a thyroid problem because this one value, TSH, isn't abnormal. And what we oftentimes in medicine do a narrower group of tests because insurance companies are kind of dictating and there's guidelines. But if you only ran a TSH and did that in all by itself and don't look at the rest of the blood chemistry panel, you wouldn't know that that TSH value might be in a normal range, but it's inappropriate given the patient who's sitting in front. And you might not know that the inflammation that patient has is what's suppressing that TSH and actually hiding a potential hypothyroid condition.
Well, let me back up just for a minute and ask, why do you think we are seeing so much hypothyroidism? I mean, it just seems like everybody, you know, has low thyroid issues, whether it's maybe not yet diagnosed, you know, more on the cellular level, which we'll talk a little bit more about, or it's actually clinically diagnosed and they're on thyroid medicine. But why is it so prevalent these days?
I think the vast majority of our clients aren't in a state we call homeostasis. They're working in a stressed, inflamed state, a state we call allostasis. So cells operate in one of two modes. They're either in a low stress state in what I call manufacturing mode, where they want to take glucose from our diet, from our nutrition, from what our body makes, bring that into a cell, convert it into cellular energy, something called ATP, and drive the manufacturing processes of the cells and of the body. So making proteins and peptides and hormones and neurotransmitters and healthy cells and cell membranes and all this great stuff that makes us feel and function well. But most of our clients aren't in that state. And so when they aren't in that state and they're in this inflammatory state, the body's other sense is, hey, if I'm a cell and I'm sensing danger, I don't want to be in manufacturing mode. I want to be in cell defense mode. And so the normal manufacturing processes get downregulated and we ramp up the immune inflammatory processes. And the thermostat in the cell, the gauge to determine whether we're in manufacturing or in cell defense is the amount of T3 in the cell. Because when you have sufficient levels of T3 in the cells, it binds to receptors and turns on the manufacturing process, and it binds to other receptors that turn off the cell defense mechanisms. But when the cell's sensing danger, then it reduces the amount of T3 in the cell, that reduces the manufacturing process and can upregulate that inflammatory process. And since so many of our clients are struggling with different levels or different types or different forms of excessive cell stress, we're just seeing the outcome of this. The hypothyroidism is not a broken physiology, in my opinion, at least at the start, but it's an adaptive response to what's going on in the body.
You know, isn't it amazing how many diseases out there, just say it all comes back to diet and lifestyle. You know, whether we're talking about hypothyroidism or, you know, autoimmune disease or whatever. I mean, there's always exceptions, but it just keeps all coming back to that, you know.
Well, it all, for the most part, it really does come down to that, right? And because there, some people like to blame everything on genetics, but I think we all have genetic polymorphisms in the body, these changes in our genes that could potentially create problems, but it's the epigenetics, the things that influence those genes, that have the bigger impact on how genes function. And the epigenetics are the things that we do in our diet and our lifestyle. And so that's probably the biggest influence, but, you know, sometimes we don't want to admit to that because it makes it feel like it's our fault. And to some degree, whether we know it or don't know it, it is a role sometimes of our habits, our behaviors, our nutrition, our lifestyles, the things we do, but we're just not aware that that's what's doing it.
So talk a little bit more, if you will, about cellular hypothyroidism. I mean, you kind of mentioned it, but that's not a term probably most people are familiar with, and it's certainly not a term that they teach in medical school anywhere. And if you ask most physicians, I would probably even say endocrinologists, what is cellular hypothyroidism? I don't know that they're, can give you a good answer. So I guess talk a little bit more about that, if you will.
Yeah, so it kind of goes with what we just said. So tissues need a certain amount of thyroid hormone to help run the metabolism of the cell, to help the gene replication and do all these important things inside the cell. Thyroid hormone T3 is a primary driver. T4 to some degree as it binds to what we call plasma receptors on the outside of the cell. But most of the things we think about are driven by the amount of thyroid hormone in the cell. And cellular hypothyroidism is just a state where there isn't enough T3 inside the cell to kind of run the machinery, or enough T4 on the outside to do the job it's supposed to do. So there's a difference between glandular hyperthyroidism and cellular hypothyroidism. Glandular hypothyroidism is when the gland can't make enough thyroid hormone. There's just, and then there, therefore, there's not enough T4, T3 in the bloodstream because the gland, which makes all of the T4, just isn't doing that. Anybody who has glandular hypothyroidism and it isn't on medication is going to have a level of cellular or tissue hypothyroidism because there's not enough stuff to get into the cell. So the cells are going to struggle with low T3 state. But somebody could have cellular or tissue hypothyroidism, low thyroid hormone in the cell, but have a perfectly normally functioning thyroid gland, and enough thyroid hormone T4 or T3 in the bloodstream.
Okay. So is that going to be a typical progression in most patients? It starts at the cellular level. Your body, isn't getting enough thyroid hormone, or it isn't working efficiently. And then if that goes untreated, then eventually your thyroid gland is going to poop out, in which case you're going to start seeing the elevated TSH, the low T4, that kind of thing. I mean, is that a typical progression?
I would say, in my opinion, the vast majority of cases start off as a cellular or tissue issue and progress to thyroiditis and then progress to glandular exhaustion. I mean, there could be cases where the gland, somebody starts, all the damage occurs at the gland with nothing else going on. But 90 plus percent, and people argue what this number is, but it's thought to be really, really high that almost all the cases of hypothyroidism, unless you've had your gland radiated or removed, it's immune driven. And if that's the case, we need to identify what that is. There is a certain percentage of people that it could be iodine deficiency. But for the most part of the cases, I would say it starts off as a tissue, cellular or tissue issue, and it starts off as an adaptive response to some type of threat.
Okay. So how can someone diagnose that if their thyroid labs are normal, but is it just a clinical diagnosis of, fatigue, weight gain, hair loss, that kind of thing? Or can they request specific labs from their doctor that's going to prove, hey, yes, I've got this quote cellular hypothyroidism?
So we don't have like a definitive marker that everybody agrees upon is going tells us what's that this is a cellular tissue hypothyroid state. If somebody has critical illness, there's a pretty good agreed the idea that people in critical illness are going to have a high reverse T3, and that's indicative of tissue hypothyroidism, non-thyroid illness syndrome, or cellular hypothyroidism, whatever you want to call it. Tactus is another name. But most physicians only consider that that happens in a critical illness state. But if you never really test reverse T3, unless somebody's critically ill, how would you How would you know if it doesn't happen in chronic illness? Now, the scientific literature says it can happen in chronic illness, chronic infections, chronic inflammation. So chronic health issues, it's going to be a factor as well. So are there tests that we can look at and get an idea that this is going on? Absolutely. Can you ask your primary care physician to run those tests? Absolutely. Are they going to run those tests? Probably not, because the medical guidelines and the insurance companies say that there's two tests that are medically necessary to diagnose and treat a thyroid condition, and that's a TSH and a free T4. So beyond that, none of the other tests are medically necessary. Now, it doesn't mean they're clinically relevant, but if the only tool you have for somebody, if they have glandular hypothyroidism, is T4 or maybe a combination of T4, T3, and we're not even aware or considering this tissue hypothyroid state, then those other tests don't become clinically necessary. So don't, if for the person who's listening to this, if you say, well, I'm gonna listen to them, I'm gonna take all those tests and ask my medical doctor to run them, don't be surprised if they say no. And they're not bad people, but their tests, their guidelines say they aren't necessary, and they don't know what to really do with those results anyway, right? Yeah. So if I don't have a tool in the toolbox, and you'd be, you know, probably one of the best people to discuss that is, hey, insurance companies don't want me to run a test that doesn't have a drug treatment at the other end of it. And do you really want to run a test and be responsible for it if you don't know what to do with it once it's done? So the tests that I like to see, what I call a full thyroid panel. If you ask your clinician, your primary care physician, or your endocrinologist to run a full thyroid panel, they will run a TSH with reflex to free T4. But I like to see TSH, total T4, total T3, free T4, free T3, reverse T3. I like to see T3 uptake. In certain situations, I like to see thyroglobulin, depending on if I'm looking for iodine issues. I like to take a look at TPO and thyroglobulin antibodies. And then from that, I'll take a look at those values. And then I'll look at the ratios of T3 to reverse T3, free T3 to reverse T3, and free T3 to free T4. And those things will give me an idea of, do I think there is a tissue hypothyroid situation going on? And of course, I look at those in context with my patient, right? What are their signs? What are their symptoms? What are they telling me? How do they look? And then once I see a pattern of tissue hypothyroidism on the thyroid panel, which might be maybe TSH could be high or low, T4 could be high or low. But if that T3 is lower and the reverse T3 is elevated, then I'm thinking I've got this tissue hypothyroid pattern going on. If I see the ratios are out of range or too low, I'll also consider the fact that I have this tissue hypothyroidism going on. And then I want to look at the rest of the lab panel to find indicators of that at the tissue status. So right away, I'll go look at my inflammatory markers, high sensitivity CRP, homocysteine, fibrinogen, ferritin, uric acid as example, to see, are there indicators of inflammation that might cause the cells or tissues to reduce the conversion of T4 to T3 and increase the conversion to this deactivated form called reverse T3. And if I see that, then I'm like, okay, I've got a patient who has signs and symptoms of hypothyroidism. I have a thyroid panel that indicates that I probably have tissue hypothyroidism. I have inflammation that would drive that process. And then the next thing I want to do is go look at the rest of my metabolic panel for patterns of tissue hypothyroidism. So I'll go see, is this a person who's got insulin resistance going on? And if they do, that's a good indication that I have that this person's struggling with some level of tissue hypothyroidism, because to get glucose into a cell doesn't just require insulin, but it requires adequate amounts of T3 inside the cell to get the glucose transporters to actually work. And those are like the revolving doors that bring glucose into a cell, both insulin dependent and insulin independent. I'll look at the lipid panel, which is a great way to look and see if a person's got tissue hypothyroidism. Why? Our cells move energy or build cellular energy by bringing glucose in and running them through something called your mitochondria. And if the mitochondria isn't functioning optimally because we have a cell in stress, then the glucose comes out through this thing called Krebs cycle and comes out and can be converted into cholesterol. Because if the cell doesn't need to make energy, I'll use that food energy and make cholesterol, which I can make into protein, into hormones and neurotransmitters and cell membranes and other great stuff. So if lipids are elevated, that's a good indication that I don't have enough T3 inside cells to actually help bring cholesterol out of the bloodstream. The liver LDL receptors require T3 to bring cholesterol out of the bloodstream. To get for, at the adrenal gland, you need T3 to bring that cholesterol out of the bloodstream so you can make it into pregnenolone and progesterone, or pregnenolone, progesterone, DHEA, cortisol. So you need these mechanisms. You need T3 inside the cells to bring it out of the bloodstream and into the cell. So there's lots of patterns that we can look at on a blood panel if the tests are done to be able to identify what tissues or what systems are struggling in this tissue hypothyroid state.
So I guess to summarize that for people, it's a lot more than just checking a TSH and a free T4 level. You really have to look at the big picture. I mean, not only more thyroid studies, but as you mentioned, to see what else is going on in the body, because they're all kind of interrelated.
Yeah. I mean, I think in my allopathic training and probably in your allopathic training, we get an overview and then we learn a systems-based approach. And those systems are all kind of separated. If you've got a thyroid problem, you go to an endocrinologist who focuses on thyroid physiology. If you have a gut problem, those are thought to be two separate issues, then you go to a gastroenterologist. If you have a cardiovascular issue, that's separate from both of them, so you go to somebody else. And so it makes it easy to study when you do it system by system, but then we miss the fact that all these systems are interrelated. And so we have to consider that if one system's compromised, there's a good probability that that's influencing another system as well. So we can see the interaction of what's going on if we run more comprehensive panels, which unfortunately, those panels get smaller and smaller every year.
Well, let's get into how you treat these people. And so if somebody, say they have signs of some, cellular hypothyroidism, which is going to be kind of the initial sign. Say, typical patient, they're having trouble losing weight, they're fatigued, they're dry skin, losing hair, whatever. Thyroid is normal. And then you run all these tests and you say, okay, it looks like you probably have some cellular hypothyroidism. And I know it depends on a lot of factors, everything you mentioned. Do they have inflammation? Do they have some, autoimmune type issues? But what, how do you work? I mean, we've worked up the patient. Now, what do you typically tell that patient? I mean, how do you go about advising them?
Well, I think in functional medicine, in the world that I work in the functional medicine approach is still a little bit different from what I discuss. I think in functional medicine, we run the tendency is to run a little bit, run that broader thyroid panel, and they're looking for many of the functional medicine practitioners are looking for a low T3 state, saying, okay, you're not converting it, and then they'll want to give T3 because the body's not converting it. I still think that's probably a mistake. So what I do is I want to, once I see the fact that somebody's got this tissue hypothyroidism going on, I want to look at their health history, their health timeline, their signs and symptoms, their diet, and their lifestyle to say what's creating the excessive stress load. And so one of the first things we want to do is start kind of picking apart their diet and their habits and their lifestyle to see like what might be triggering it. So diet is probably a great place to start, and find out what they're eating. Unfortunately, we have a tendency to a lot of processed foods, which are tend to be more unhealthy. And so I like to get people just to shift from maybe the standard American diet to more of a whole food based diet. I think that's a great place for people to start. Anybody, I don't care what your health care problem is. If your diet is not whole food based, that's a great place to start. And it doesn't cost you anything to do that. It's actually probably cheaper than what you're probably eating and snacking on. So that's step one. Step two is to start looking at their habits and behaviors and start working through that process. What's your sleep habits? What's your exercise habits? What's your emotional stress like? What's your environmental stress like? So we can start working on those things that may be contributing to it. And then the next thing we want to do is take a look at their overall physiology and decide what systems we can start working on by with those lifestyle and nutrition changes, but then some strategic supplemental strategies. One of the first places I often look to start is to look at the GI tract, because everything needs to go in through the GI tract. Everything needs to come out through the GI tract. So if somebody's got a really unhealthy GI tract, we need to do some things to help stabilize that. And so we'll start to work on that process. I'd like to work on kind of managing the inflammatory process, not necessarily suppressing it, because inflammation isn't necessarily a bad thing, but trying to manage it, it's a good thing. And then I just keep start as I'm going through treatment with them. Each visit, I'm typically working on a diet, modifying that diet to get them from maybe an, we'll start them with whole food, maybe get them to AIP, then start reintroducing foods and see how they do, because we don't want them on a restrictive diet for an extended period of time. And then working through all the systems that are challenged and need some support because they've been adapting for so long that they're actually starting to break down. So it's nothing sexy, and there's no individual, I'm not a protocol person, where you say, hey, what's your gut protocol or what's your detox? I don't have one, because everybody's different. So the protocol that, or the solution for one person's GI problems may be different than it are for somebody else's GI problems. I think protocols are more allopathically based, although we've really used them quite a bit in functional medicine as well. But we should be looking at somebody's health history, their health time on their labs, and the feedback that they're giving us to on treatment to make changes on the fly. Like, okay, this strategy that we've implied looks good on paper, but it's not necessarily working well for you. So we need to make some modifications to it.
So everything you're suggesting, unfortunately is going to take a while to change, and everybody wants results now. But do you ever recommend, or do you feel like it's indicated to start somebody on a thyroid medicine, maybe temporarily to see if it will make them feel better as they're making all these changes? For instance, a typical patient that I will see all the time maybe has a slightly elevated TSH, maybe a little bit on the lower normal free T3, still in range, but maybe lower normal, but they have all these signs, clinical signs of hypothyroidism. Do you ever recommend going ahead and starting them on something, at least initially, to kind of give them that boost of energy to help motivate the change?
So if somebody is clearly hypothyroid and they're not on medication, then I'll often recommend that they get started on something. Because if you don't have enough in the system to even run the basic systems and the kind of the backup systems, that can be problematic. But for the average person who's not, they have enough T4 in the bloodstream, but their T3 is low. Absolutely, you could give them some thyroid hormones, some maybe a boost of T4. Maybe you give them a little bit of T3, and they might have a burst of feeling a little bit better. But I think for most of the people, it's contraindicated. If from the way I look at the cell physiology, if I'm a cell and I didn't want the thyroid hormone that I already had in my system, why is forcing more into the system a good idea? Right. And so, yeah, could you normalize the labs? Absolutely. But what I see in my practice over and over again is somebody who was given thyroid hormone when they're not diagnosed glandular yet, and somebody says, well, I think you have hypothyroidism, it's just not showing up yet, I'll just put you on some. They wind up getting on some medication. Sometimes they feel that initial boost of feeling better, and then it plateaus. And so then they go, okay, well, let's give you some more. So they'll get more T4 and they go, okay, I feel a little bit better. And then it plateaus. And then they get to a point where they start to say, I'm starting to get brain fog and my mind's racing. I'm getting insomnia and their TSH is being overly suppressed. And they're like, even now on the stronger dose, I'm getting hyperthyroid symptoms and I still have hypothyroid symptoms, or those are getting worse. Or this other scenario where somebody will say, well, your TSH is good, your T4 is okay, but your T3 is low and your reverse T3 is high. So I'm going to give you more T3 And I think the same situation happens. They start off on 5 micrograms and initially feel better, and then they plateau, and then they go to 10 micrograms and then they feel better, and then they plateau. And then they wind up, many of my clients come to see me and they're on 25, 30 or more micrograms of T3 and T4 at the same time. And they're taking sometimes double or triple the amount of thyroid hormone that their body would make in any given day. And they still have hypothyroid symptoms. So I don't like that trap. I'm usually trying to do the opposite. I'll look at their panel and say, look, we'll keep an eye on it. If there's insufficient T4 in the system, then we need to get them some T4. And I'll say, hey, go back to your primary care and let's get you a prescription of T4 to get started. But what I want to do is not necessarily jump to the, let me give you the T3, unless their gland has been removed or it's been irradiated, because what I want to do is be able to use the ratios that I see on that thyroid panel as a gauge of whether I'm doing a better job helping that person convert their T4 to T3. So what typically happens for the clients that are not on thyroid medication yet, after about 30 days, 60 days, we're already seeing the improvement of those of the T3 values and the dropping of reverse T3. And for the patients that are already on thyroid medication, many times what we need to, what I need to do, and I don't prescribe, so I'll say to them, listen, you need to get off or reduce, not get off, but reduce your medication. And I'll give some recommendations that they can take back to their prescribing doc and say, hey, this is, here's what we want to do, and here's what we need to do. And I, at this point, in my, when I first started off, we'd get a lot of pushback from endocrinologists and general care practitioners, like, hey, who's this guy to tell us, to tell me to do that? But anymore, I don't get much pushback at all when the clients go back, because one, they've probably already seen some results already. The patients that are already been diagnosed or have chronic health issues, they continue to go back to their doctors. Many times their doctors are already frustrated to begin with and or don't know what to do with them anyway. So they're like, okay, let's try it. What the heck do we got to lose? And we're not doing this blindly. We're looking at labs, we're making assessments based on the labs. And then I'm always retesting them about 30 days after a dose change, re-looking at that thyroid panel to make sure it's gone the direction we want it to, as well as running at least one or two tissue indicators of how that thyroid hormone is impacting their insulin resistance, their lipid panel, or something else.
And I was going to ask you what you do with people who are already on thyroid medication. How often are you able to get them completely off thyroid medication? And again, assuming they're not on it if they've had a complete thyroidectomy and that kind of stuff. But
So it varies depending on how long somebody's had a problem. It's thought that the thyroid gland turns over about every 8 years. So, is there a possibility or probability that the thyroid gland can recover? Yeah, I mean, I've had lots of patients that were able to eliminate their dose, but that's usually never the goal of what, a lot of times people say, I'm coming to you because I don't feel good on thyroid medication. I want to stop taking. I don't want to ever have to take it again. Okay. Well, we're not going to probably accomplish that in the next 6 months, but that it may happen. But our goal should be to have you take the least amount of hormone that you need and have it work optimally in the system. And so that's always the goal. So it is almost just about every patient I've ever seen has had to reduce their dosage over time. There's, I don't know of a client in 20 some years where we've had to increase their dose through care. It's always been a reduction of dose. And we see a number of clients just not needed at all over time.
Okay, so it is possible for them to wean completely off of that. It would just take a long time.
It could be. I mean, and there's some people that are medicated and we have to, they don't need to be on it at all. And so they need almost some of those clients that almost need to be off it right away. And they're like, oh my gosh, I feel so much better. Right. So how we make that decision is really based on the individuals, their signs and symptoms, how much medication they're taking, what do we see on the lab results. Yeah, but there are clients that are like, they just never should have been on it to begin with. But somebody, they were trying to help them out. They figured, hey, I'll give them some. And it just wasn't, it just didn't make sense. So Each case is a little bit different, a little bit unique. I mean, if somebody is a person who got diagnosed a year or two ago and started on thyroid medication, they have a much better chance of getting off that medication completely quicker. But if it's a person who's been on thyroid medication for 2 or 3 decades, I don't know. That's going to probably take some time because that you got it allow for time for the thyroid gland to start to recover. So it could be a year or more until that thyroid gland really starts to produce enough thyroid hormone on their own. But if I try and get people to understand that the goal isn't to just eliminate your medication, it's to get you functioning well so that your gland can do what it's supposed to do naturally, and then the body and the tissue will convert that thyroid hormone the way it's designed versus deactivating it.
So if they're not on, I may have already asked this, but if they're not on thyroid medication yet, but we are seeing an elevated TSH, low T4, do you have success reversing those people without thyroid medication through lifestyle?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. So those people don't immediately have to start necessarily on
Yeah,
something.
and so this question was asked earlier today, like, do you like an optimal do you like a somebody's TSH to be in between like 1 and 2? And I'm like, I don't know what the situation is. So if this is a person who's got low T4 and maybe lower T3, or a normal T4 and a low T3, I don't want their TSH to be 1 to 2. I want it to be 3 or 4 or 5. Why? Because the TSH is going to stimulate the thyroid gland to make T4, to make T3. Matter of fact, if T3 is low, the pituitary gland will change that TSH signal to the thyroid gland to make more T3 versus T4. So why would we want to suppress TSH in that situation? And that kind of goes back to your other question, like, should we just give them the T3 just to help them feel good? Well, maybe that makes sense, but maybe it doesn't, because if I give them some T3, now I suppress TSH, and now the thyroid gland can't help what the peripheral tissues aren't doing. This point is argued a bunch too. We know it's thought that somewhere around 10, 5, 10% maybe, small amount of T3 is made by the thyroid gland, but more could be made by the thyroid gland given the right signaling. The majority of T3 is thought to be made by the peripheral tissues taking the T4 and converting it to T3. And if that isn't occurring, that's often why the T4 could be normal and the T3 could be low. So we want that TSH to be a little bit higher. We don't want it at 20 or 30 or 40, right? If the gland's not listening anymore. But if it's 5 or 6, let's give it a little bit more time, especially if they're working with somebody like me who's helping them address the root issues. Now, if it's somebody who's not working on their health and their lifestyle and their diet and nutrition, and those values are off, well, then go get the medication because you're not working on the things that are going to correct it. But if they're working on the things to correct it, let's just give it a little bit of time. Let's monitor again in 30 days, see if it's improving. And oftentimes it is improving without
Interesting.
medication.
Interesting. How do you change your strategies, or do you, when they have Hashimoto's, which is, probably the most common cause of hypothyroidism? We like to monitor the thyroid antibodies and actually like to see those go down as low as possible. We've started doing a lot of low dose naltrexone, and we've had a lot of success with that, and just kind of helping decrease inflammation. I don't know if you're familiar with that or use that a lot, but how do your recommendations differ specifically for Hashimoto's?
It doesn't differ at all, because I think there's a misunderstanding in the education process that Hashimoto's, or that immune-driven thyroiditis, when somebody has hypothyroidism, it's immune-driven. Okay. And the differentiation of whether it's just immune-driven thyroiditis or Hashimoto's is these things called TPO or thyroglobulin antibodies. And it's thought that maybe that's a different thing. I don't think it's a different thing. When you look at the scientific literature that's out there now, there's two parts to the adaptive immune system. There's a TH1 or T cell driven component and a TH2 side of that, which drives the antibody response. And so oftentimes thyroiditis and this immune-driven thyroiditis shifts back and forth from a Th1-driven disorder to a Th2-driven disorder. So if somebody's in a more Th2-driven process, their antibodies could be really, really high. If they're in a Th1-dominant process, they may have very low antibodies or none at all, but still have Hashimoto's. So Hashimoto's often starts as T1 and then shifts to that Th2. There's a lab called Cyrex Labs. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them, but Cyrex Labs runs a panel called a lymphocyte map panel. And I've run lymphocyte maps on thyroid with since it's come out on my patients with diagnosed hypothyroidism and thyroid and Hashimoto's and patients without. And the vast majority of the clients are Th1 dominant, unless we see really high antibodies, and those patients are typically Th2 dominant. So the name Hashimoto's, I think we make a bigger deal of that than it should be. The other piece that's really important is that based on some of the scientific literature, the thyroid antibodies don't cause much of the damage at all to the thyroid gland. We, in my training, kind of taught that the thyroid antibodies are like little Pac-Men eating away the thyroid gland. And the literature says that's not what happens. Most of the damage is done by infiltrating lymphocytes. Thyroglobulin antibodies are thought to cause no damage to the thyroid gland, and TPO antibodies are thought to cause very little, if any, damage to the thyroid gland. So what's doing it? When a person has what can activate the thyroiditis is thyroid cells have these things called pattern recognition receptors on the cell membrane. And these pattern recognition receptors are sense to two key things: pathogen-associated molecular patterns and damage-associated molecular patterns, or DNA-associated molecular patterns. And so these are little particles that float around in the body and can bind to the thyroid cells, and that ish initiates those thyroid cells to become immune-like, almost self-destruct, and then release inflammatory cytokines into the bloodstream that then attracts the lymphocytes to the thyroid gland. So it's not that the antibodies are just floating around eating this stuff. It's that the cells themselves and that initiate the process are releasing these cytokines that are inviting the process there. So I keep an eye on the thyroid antibodies, but it doesn't really change the treatment per se because something is triggering the thyroiditis to begin with. So I got to figure out what that is, what type of stress is triggering that process. And from my perspective, and I talk about this in the book, cells in danger or cells that have been damaged release these PAMPs, pathogen-associated molecular peptides. So if I'm a cell and I'm in danger and I've got a virus or a bacteria that's impacting me, I can break down that bacteria or virus and release particles of that into the bloodstream. And those little particles bind to the immune cells, and that lets the immune cells know, hey, this is the thing we're looking for. This is the thing we got to go find and destroy. The cell that's in danger can also release its own DNA fragments that go out into the bloodstream, and that alerts the immune cells to what cells being damaged, and now the immune system can come to that tissue. I think it's really important to realize that the thyroid gland has receptors for those same DAMPs and PAMPs. And so if I'm a cell and I'm perceiving an infection, I'm going to downregulate my metabolism, decrease the amount of T3 inside the cell, initiate this tissue hypothyroidism. And then the things that I release to stimulate the immune system to kill the infection and to come to my aid, those things can circulate into the bloodstream, go to the thyroid gland, and then bind to the thyroid gland, which can cause the thyroid gland to then start to be downregulated. We call it thyroiditis. But oftentimes, when somebody's diagnosed with Hashimoto's, we think like the immune system's out of control and it's just woke up one day and it doesn't like the gland anymore. I'm just going to get rid of it. I don't think that's the case. I think it's more of an adaptive response. And the reason I say that is because when we work with people and we improve their diet, we get rid of their infections and improve their dysbiosis and calm all the things that upregulate the immune system, guess what happens naturally is the antibodies go down. The thyroiditis starts to improve. The gland starts to recover. So if it's an immune system that just woke up one day and it's out of control, that's a What are you going to do? But if it's an immune system that's adaptively trying to slow down the metabolism to protect the organism, man, that's a different place to come from. Your body's not attacking you. It's trying to protect you by slowing down the metabolism and ramping up defense. I think it's a better position to put our clients in than to say you have this autoimmune condition that's trying to kill you.
But do you find some people can do all the right things, and they're generally healthy people and still have these elevated thyroid antibodies?
Well, I think the issue is when we say they're generally healthy, what does that mean, right? Are they because they look good, right? Look, my example is a great example of that. I would have told you I was more than generally healthy, but I was in my 40s training, running triathlons and marathons and doing adventure races and all this fun stuff. And one day I go get my blood work done just to prove to myself how good healthy I am. And I'm insulin resistant, Hashimoto's, and insulin resistant cholesterol is up, Hashimoto's, so, inflammatory markers are up. I look good, I eat good, but what I had to do then is take a step back and say, let me see if I can be honest with myself. What else is going on here? I'm training way too much, not allowing for enough recovery. I'm sleeping about 4 hours a day because sleeps for the week, and I got stuff to do. Multiple broken noses, poor nasal breathing. So I'm probably breathing through my mouth all night. And just work and parenting and life stress, right? So I look good on the outside, fit, but I'm not, I wasn't healthy. If I'm honest with myself, I wasn't healthy. I think one of the big problems that we have is we need to figure out how we can have a uniform definition of what health is and how we're going to measure it. But I take care of a lot of athletes, and so they all think they're healthy, and they're some of the most unhealthy people that I come in contact with because they are healthy in certain aspects of their life, especially their physical fitness, but at the cost of all the other systems breaking down.
So it sounds like you think we in the medical community are too quick to treat thyroid in general, but specifically Hashimoto's when we see those antibodies up and oh, we got to do something about that. So it just all kind of goes back to that lifestyle intervention, let the body kind of heal itself. And those will all, if you're doing the right things, that'll all work out. Those will all come down on their own.
No,
Not
I
necessarily.
don't think so, because I think allopathic medicine oftentimes is not jumping in too early because they don't have a tool to assess and address. So they're not jumping in too early often for thyroid issues because the person hasn't lost 90% of their thyroid function by the time when they're coming in complaining. So for TSH to be lab high and free T4 to be lab low, the literature says that the person's lost better than 90% of the function of their thyroid gland. That's not the beginning of a problem. So if they were jumping in too early, it would be they're giving thyroid medication when the person is starting to put weight on and they're tired, fatigue, and have a normal TSH and a normal T4. I don't think that person should be getting thyroid medication at that point. And there has been arguments. Well, what if they have a high TSH and a normal free T4? Should we give that? I mean, the literature is full of that argument and discussion. Maybe when do we put them on? And I still think that's the wrong way to look at it. That when we see that, we shouldn't be saying, having the argument, should I put this person on it or shouldn't I? We should be saying, what is the body's physiology adapting to? Why is the body doing that? And that's the question we should be asking from a functional medicine perspective. And we should be, and we often do. The allopathic physician's job, I just see it as a different job. If you're an allopathic physician and you're allopathically trained, you're trained to diagnose and treat disease as kind of a root foundational thing. Acute care is fantastic. Allopathic care is awesome at acute care. They're awesome at managing chronic conditions, especially for the people that don't want to change their diet or their lifestyle. But for the person who doesn't want to be on a lifetime of medication, they actually do want to get healthy. We need a different set of diet of definition for what health is. We need a different standard for how we're going to assess it and measure it. And then we need different options for those people and a different th thought process and paradigm to say, oh, you don't want to change anything, but we can't have you walking around with high blood pressure and high cholesterol. That go see this allopathic physician. He's going to give you a statin. He's going to give you blood pressure medication, and that'll manage your condition, and you'll probably need more care. But if the person comes in and says, hey, I have high cholesterol, high blood pressure, I'm insulin resistant, but I don't want to do medication. Okay, are you willing to change your diet and lifestyle? Yes. Okay. Well, then we've got a set different set of thought process, a different set of tests, and a different process for helping you heal and get healthy and get well. We have to. So I think that I was really hard on allopathic medicine when I left it because of my own health issues that I had as well. But I'm softer now. I don't, if you want to practice allopathic medicine, I know you're more of a functional practitioner at this point, but that's fine. I mean, we need people to do that because people aren't going to do what you or I want them to do without their diet and lifestyle. There's people that you're going to see and say, hey, man, we got to clean up your diet. We got to eat, fewer carbs. We got to get you working on, we got to work on your sleep. We got to make some that lifestyle. I don't want to do that. I'm busy. I want to do what I want to do. I just don't want to have high blood pressure. Great. There's a treatment for you. And just so you know, if and when you don't want to be on medications, there's another option, but you've got to be willing to change something in your diet and lifestyle. But I don't think it's one or the other. I think what we need to do is build a bridge between the two professions and say, hey, you do that job really well. But for the people that don't want what you have to offer, offer them the other thing, the alternative. I don't think it has to be one or the other. I think it could be both.
Yeah. No, well said. I think a lot of people though don't know that there's another option. They see these, normal doctors, I'll say normal, and all they've ever known is I get medicines for my blood pressure, I get medicines for cholesterol, I get medicines for my thyroid, and they don't really know that there's other options because the doctor never tells them of that, or the doctor probably doesn't know. So
And there's no TV commercials that talk
that's right.
about functional medicine, right?
Yeah,
So
right.
there's no big money behind health, true healthcare,
Yeah, no, you're
right?
right.
So,
Yeah.
and I had this conversation with, the doctor from Paraguay that we were talking about earlier, and they have the same type of process in Paraguay that we have here. It's insurance run practice, into healthcare industry. And we had a discussion about it, and I said, the way we fix it here and the way you fix it there is you don't have a third party in between the patient and the physician. If you want to have insurance, that's fine. But all payments, I've got to pay you for your full service out of my pocket, and then I can send it in for reimbursement later. But there's no, hey, it's a $10 copay. If your visit's $200, then I have to take the $200 out of my pocket and pay you for that. If you're going to give me a prescription, it's not $5 for the prescription. That's not what the medication costs. The patients need to know now what the full cost of that choice is. And when you tell them it's $5 for that statin, they go, oh, why wouldn't I want to do that? But if you said, hey, you're going to pay for this, I'll put you on the statin. If you don't want to change it, it's going to be $450 a month into perpetuity. That will make people change what they do. They're going to be like, wait a minute, this prescription's $450 for the month, and I have to take a blood pressure medication too? Yeah. Well, how much is that? Well, that's $375. Well, wait a minute. You're telling me I'm going to have to be on $800 of medication every month forever? Well, no, I'm not telling you forever. I'm telling you're going to be that on those two medications for definitely forever. But you might be on more if you don't make some changes to what's caused this. So the 800 is the short-term cost, but it's probably going to get worse with time. But the good news is, if you're willing to make some diet and lifestyle changes, you might not need these medications, and you might not need more medications until maybe the last 5 or 10 years of your life, if you're lucky, because you and I know this. When we were kids, the disease span was like the last 5 or 10 years of somebody's life. And currently, the disease span or the sick span is about 40 to 45 years of somebody's life.
Yeah.
There's our healthcare problem.
Well, okay. I know we talked about a lot of stuff, and people may be overwhelmed with the science, I guess, that what we got into with the thyroid. Definitely makes me step back and think even about some things that I'm doing. But if people would like to just know more about this, go read the book. It's a good book called The Thyroid Debacle. And I know you can probably get that at Amazon or anywhere. They also have a website, thyroiddebacle.com. Is there any other website or anything that you're on?
My office website is rejuvigencenter.com, and if anybody wants to reach out to me, they can go there. If they want to talk to me, and I offer discovery calls where they can go there and schedule a 15-minute conversation where we can just kind of talk about what's going on with them and maybe what answer some of their questions or what talk to them about what options are available. I have a podcast of my own called The Thyroid Debacle, where I talk about thyroid physiology, talk about something called the cell danger response, which we kind of hinted to through this presentation. And we talk about all aspects of just everything that affects health and well-being. So you can go and listen to that. And then I'm on Instagram, Dr. Eric Balcavage, and probably every day we've got some type of health and wellness post. I've got these Thyroid Thursday educational posts I put on there every week to try and just give people more information. Buyer beware. I'm more of the education person versus the dancing TikTok person, like pointing to the captions on the thing. I'm more of, I want to teach you something about your physiology so that way you can say, okay, now I understand why that is or why it works. So I've had some people say, why don't you do the captions and the dance? Like, people love that stuff. Well, I don't. That's not me. I want to teach somebody why they have a thyroid physiology problem. I want to teach them something about the lab values so they don't get bamboozled and somebody telling you, hey, we need to do this because this is what's going on in your body. Some of those things that we even say in functional medicine just have no, they're not true. So I want to try and educate as much as I can.
Okay, well, good stuff. Well, really appreciate your time today. As we wrap up here, I always ask my guests if they could give us one health tip that could make us healthier today. What would you say to that?
Yeah, the thing I would say is appreciate every day. I think too many of us are walking around complaining and bitching and moaning about what we don't have, and we're so problem focused that we can't see a solution or ever work on a solution. So, I think be grateful for the fact that you're still here, that you're still moving. Stop focusing on your problem and start focusing on what can I do to change to improve my situation, regardless of whatever it is.
Very good. Great advice. So, very interesting topic. And yeah, just really appreciate your time. Appreciate everyone listening. Dr. Eric Balcavage. I still don't think I said it
You
right,
got
but
it.
all right. Well, thanks again. And we will just talk to everyone next time.
All right. Thanks, Ray.
Thank you for listening to FitRx. I invite you to share this with friends and family. If you would like, you can check out our website at vibrantlifedc.com, or you can email me at drgreg@vibrantlifedc.com.